This lesson is from the course Fullness of Joy, A Biblical Theology of God with Us by Dr. Daniel Ragusa.
God's covenant promise, I will be your God and you will be my people, is the refrain that is heard at every turn in redemptive history to the glory of God's name and the good of his people. Now, we've already considered the blueprint of God's plan for fellowship with his people in the garden, and the way in which he has continued to pursue that even in the face of sin and death during the era of the patriarchs under the administration of the covenant of grace in the Abrahamic covenant. However, we saw last time that the meetings between God and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all of them at the altars ached for something more, which were only faint and fading experiences of God's presence. What was needed was for God to take up residence in the midst of his people. But the question is, how can a holy God dwell in the midst of a sinful people in a sin-cursed world under the shadow of death? How could that happen? Well, we see this take place as the story moves forward. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Jacob's sons, the 12 sons, are eventually, by God's providence, brought into Egypt. And there in Egypt, they're given a place to live and stay and to have their families. But a Pharaoh, who no longer remembered Joseph, rises to power. And God has been faithful to his people. They have been multiplying and being fruitful. And the Pharaoh then begins to fear this people and begins to impose harsh regulations upon them and to persecute them. And under the burden of Pharaoh, under his tyranny, the people of God begin to cry out. And God raises up a mediator. God raises up someone in the name of Moses who would come to deliver his people out of Egypt and bring them into a new land. And so Moses, as he fled from Egypt, finds himself in the desert. And there he sees this remarkable sight. He's drawn to this bush that is burning, but is not being consumed. And we read in Exodus chapter 3 of this story. It says there that Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian. And he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And bringing a sense of continuity to the story, God says to Moses, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at him. God will go on to tell Moses that he has heard the cries of his people. How could he not, as their covenant God? How could he not, as he has pledged himself to his people? And he is going to, and he sends Moses and commissions Moses to appear before Pharaoh to demand that he let his people go. And through various contests with Pharaoh and his magicians and the 10 plagues, God, with a mighty hand, brings his people out of Egypt. And God begins to lead his people by this peculiar yet marvelous cloud as a pillar of fire by night and a cloud by day. And we read of the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. It was God himself who had come, God himself who had appeared in the cloud to lead his people out of Egypt through the Red Sea and through the wilderness. It is this very same cloud that would descend upon Mount Sinai. And within that, the thick cloud, God himself would appear as Moses ascended the mountain and came into the presence of God to meet with him. It's there that God met with his people. And Mount Sinai, as God had descended upon it, and his presence is there, we might think of Mount Sinai as a kind of temple, a place where God is found, a mountain temple. And there, as Moses is brought into the mountain, into the cloud, the Lord instructs him to receive free will contributions from the people in order to build a sanctuary according to the blueprint that God would show him. And the question becomes, why? Why is God giving Moses these architectural plans for building a tabernacle, for building a sanctuary? Well, God gives us the reason in Exodus 25, verse 8. God says, "Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst." God was having his people construct the tabernacle that he might come and dwell in their midst, that no longer would he come temporarily to meet with his people at altar sites, but he would have an address in the midst of his people, that his home, a place of his dwelling, would be there close to his people, and there that they would find him to be near to them, God drawing near to be with his people. And so as God then equips the various builders in order to construct the tabernacle, and they do so according to the specifications that God had given to them, that very same cloud of glory that led his people out of Egypt through the Red Sea to Mount Sinai, that very same cloud now fills that tabernacle, the glory of the Lord, the presence of God coming to take up residence in this place. We read of this in Exodus 40, verse 34, 35. It says, "The cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." God himself with his people. God himself coming to dwell in the midst of his people. But as we said earlier, how can God be in the midst of a sinful people? How can God, who is a consuming fire, be in the midst of a sinful people in a sin-cursed world under the shadow of death? And so God, through Moses, implements the sacrificial system and the ceremonies of the law. And these ceremonies and sacrifices serve God's gracious purpose. They are there to remind the people that it is not by their righteousness, it's not by their inherent worth, it's not by the fact that sin did not affect them, but rather it was by God's grace alone and God's provision alone that he would come and dwell in the midst of his people. That blood was needed to pay for the sins of his people. That atonement must be made, and that God himself would ultimately provide it for his people. What then we begin to see in the covenant that God makes with Moses and the nation of Israel is that the serpent crusher and the son of Abraham would also be a Lamb of God who would take away the sin of the world. That he would be the one to fulfill all of the sacrifices and all of the ceremonies, and that all of them were given to God's people to foreshadow the coming sacrifice that would do away with sin once for all. While these sacrifices under the Mosaic covenant had to be repeated, even on the Day of Atonement, right, once a year, the great sacrifices would be made, and yet they would be made the next year again, and the next year again, and the next year again. All of it pointing forward to the once-for-all sacrifice who would do away with sin once and for all, who would truly and forever remove the sins of God's people as far as the east is from the west, and who would come and bury their sins at the bottom of the ocean, never ever to surface Again, this is what the sacrificial system and the ceremonies of the law all were anticipating. That Lamb of God who would take away the sin of the world, who would truly restore God's people and bring them back into his presence where there is fullness of joy and pleasures forevermore. Now the tabernacle that was built, as we said earlier, was patterned after something, right? God is giving to his people instructions. And this helps us to see something more about the tabernacle and how, while it was a good thing, and in the tabernacle, God met with his people, and yet we see that it was not a permanent thing. It was not the final thing, that God would come nearer to his people, even more near than the tabernacle allowed. And so we see how the tabernacle itself was patterned after the heavenly tabernacle of God, the heavenly temple where God's glory filled, the heavenly place where Isaiah was once brought, and he saw the train of the Lord's robe filling it and filling it with his glory. We read about this in Hebrews chapter 8, verses 5 and 6. It speaks there of the priests who served the earthly tabernacle and temple. It says there that they serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown to you on the mountain." That pattern was the very pattern of that heavenly temple. So that the tabernacle was the place where God met with his people. But we also think of it as the heavenly tabernacle, the heavenly temple, casting its shadow down upon the earth, and there, in the midst of the camp of Israel, the tabernacle, the earthly tabernacle, was a copy and a shadow of the heavenly thing. And as a copy and as a shadow, it looked forward to the day when the substance, the thing itself, would come down out of heaven, and he who is the true temple of God would dwell among us. He who is Emmanuel. And so again, while the tabernacle was good, and it mediated God's presence to his people through the priests and through the sacrifices and through the ceremonies, still it looked forward to something greater, something more permanent. A second marvelous thing we see about this tabernacle is that while it is a shadow of heaven on earth, and while God has taken up residence there, it moves just as God's people move. God's people at this time were not yet settled. They're still in the wilderness. They're a pilgrim people on their way. And God, in his condescending grace and mercy, in his kindness to his people and his love for his people, he goes with them and is with them in the wilderness, so that as they endure, as they are tested, God is with them. As they are without food and without water, God is with them. As they are facing enemies and threats, God is with them. And they are called then to trust the presence of God with them. And in the midst of the wilderness, in the midst of barrenness and emptiness, in the midst of uncertainty, they are to trust his promise. And in that, the promise itself provides for them living water. The promise provides for them sustenance and energy and strength to move forward as God himself will lead them into the promised land. That God himself, as Moses reflects upon at the end of Deuteronomy, that God himself, like a great and mighty eagle, would bear them on his wings, and he would bring them through the wilderness, safely and securely into the land that he has promised them. This is the power of God's presence among his people. And this is the power of his promise that they might find life and living water and strength even in the midst of the wilderness. And the author of Hebrews will draw a parallel between that people then and the church today. And as God's presence and his promise gave them power so too God's presence and his promise equips the church, as we'll see in a later lesson more fully, to go forth and in by faith, trusting that God is with us. Emmanuel, he was with them in the wilderness, bringing them to that promised land, and he is with us today, bringing us to our heavenly country. And so God was with them, and he had drawn near to them in the tabernacle. Now, one last topic we want to think about is the way then in which the tabernacle connects with what was, what is, and what will be. As we said, the tabernacle was not the final destination. More was to come. And it also reflected on what had already come as well. First, it reflected on what was, namely the Garden of Eden. In the tabernacle, we have arboreal imagery. We have imagery as if a garden is being replanted in the midst of the camp of Israel. The tabernacle was entered from the east, even as Adam and Eve had been banished east of Eden. Now they're returning back into the presence of God. The lampstand in the tabernacle may have resembled the tree of life. The priests who were to guard and keep the sanctuary, the tabernacle, are given the very same commands to work and keep as Adam had been given in the garden. And so we see the tabernacle and God's wisdom intentionally mirroring and reflecting what had come before, reminding God's people that he has not forgotten his purposes from the very beginning. And God will see his promise through, even in the face of sin and death. He will fulfill his purposes. That's what the tabernacle is powerfully and boldly declaring in the midst of the wilderness. It also speaks of what is, that the tabernacle, as we've been saying, is the residence of God. It's the house of God, the place that God's people long to be, that David himself tells us as his covenant of grace inspires him with confidence to say in Psalm 5, verse 7, "But I, through the abundance of your steadfast love, will enter your house." And his people, bound to a fellowship of life with him in the midst of the wilderness, would say with David that there is one thing of the Lord that they would ask and one thing that they would seek after, to dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of their life. Now, again, we see the tabernacle as good but not permanent, because though God took up residence, it was once a year that the high priest could go into the Holy of Holies before the presence of God. And so it looked forward to the day when all God's people would appear before him, and all God's people would be led up his mountain into his house and before his altar. And so while the tabernacle was good, it was not yet the final, ultimate thing. And so it not only pointed to what was in Eden and what is in the house of God, but also what will be. As the tabernacle reflected the cosmos, as it reflected the creation, the world all around it, and as the tabernacle itself became a holy place, as God took up residence there, as the cloud filled it, so too the tabernacle is prophesying of the day when the glory of the Lord would not fill this small cube in the midst of Israel's camp, but would fill the entire earth in a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. The tabernacle anticipates the future that is to come when the glory of the Lord and the knowledge of the Lord covers the earth, even as the waters cover the sea. Right? That is what God is aiming for. And the tabernacle provides a stepping stone to that end, as God is preparing his people and the whole world to one day receive his glory, and that his glory will one day fill it all and transform it all, and all of it will be marked holy unto the Lord.
Thank you for listening to this lesson from Reformed Academy. We trust it has been a blessing to you, and we encourage you to use this course in your church or otherwise share it with others who may benefit from this teaching. At Reformed Forum, we are committed to providing redemptive, historical, biblical, and theological education freely to people around the world. All of our courses are available online at reformedforum.org, many with Spanish and Chinese subtitles, all entirely for free. If you would like to support our mission and help us continue offering these valuable resources, please visit reformedforum.org/donate. With your partnership, more people can access sound, reformed teaching, and together, by God's grace, we can equip the next generation of church leaders for faithful service.